First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
How on earth can we process all of the collective trauma Americans are carrying? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we speak with a local trauma-informed leader. What is that? Well, keep listening to find out and give us a call. Share your stories. 549-2937. Then later, our contributor Chris Hand, a preview of Jazz Fest weekend, and a special Jax Today deep dive into efforts to tame those high rents out there. It's all ahead. But first this hour, the nation is suffering from collective trauma. The effects of the pandemic, never-ending horrific mass shootings, a coup attempt, and more have Americans reeling these days. And, you know, it begs the question, how do we deal with this? In our homes, with our kids, and at our jobs. One local health leader is working to make the workplace better equipped to deal with trauma. Dr. Don Emmerich, LinkedIn learning instructor, TEDx Jacksonville speaker, and more, joins us now in studio to share some really timely and hopefully healing information. Hi, Don. Good to see you.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. Are you carrying trauma? Are you stressed? Are you anxious? What are your questions about trauma-informed leadership? Do you feel safe at your workplace? What about your kid at school? What are your worries there? Give us a call, 549-2937, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa Injax. Facebook, always open. Well, let me begin by asking you, what is trauma-informed leadership?
You know, it's a leadership style that, quite frankly and basically, is where your decisions as a leader is not doing any additional harm to your workforce. That's just the plainness. I can get fancy, but that's just it. Mm-hmm. Any of the decisions that we are making, how we're interacting, how we're engaging, the policy decisions that are made in workplaces, the screening question is this going to do harm to physical, emotional, psychological? Is it going to do harm? And that's the decision that you have to make.
Well, that's common sense. But I'm sure a lot of people out there don't realize they might be causing harm to their fellow workers, their colleagues, particularly right now. I mean, the country is hurting so badly. People are horrified and outraged by yet another mass shooting, this one in Texas, Dawn, that killed 19 little kids. It is so hideous, and it is so maddening that as a country, we can't find the leadership to effectively deal with this problem and so many others.
Yeah. And you know, Melissa, let me just also just say, this is not a new space. Trauma-informed has been around for a long time. And trauma-informed care, actually, we're talking 25, 30 plus years, but that has always been researched and validated in the health and human services sector, behavioral health sector, or even the healthcare sector. They've been doing this work for a long time. And most of this work has been where workers in those environments have been trained to be better responsive to the families who are trying to access their services, right? So that's the trauma-informed care piece. The problem with that approach over the last several years is that organizations in those sectors have only trained 1/3 or 25% of their employees on this concept, because it's only those that are doing the interaction with the families. But what about the other 75% of the organization? And so you have a significant number of people in businesses or in the organizations that are not exposed to a trauma-informed workplace because they do not do direct service. Fast forward to where we are now. Right. And so we know that trauma is now impacting everyone. It's not just those people. And I have quotes, right? Because that's what you hear, is it's just those people that need that. No, we are in a crisis in this country. And so now businesses, all businesses, private sector, public sector, nonprofit, every single one of our businesses have got to assume the universal decision that people are coming into the workplace with collective trauma. You have to.
I think that's absolutely right. And I read a piece yesterday explaining that you didn't have to be at the scene of that shooting in Texas to be traumatized. Secondary trauma is real.
It is real. And I'll just give you a personal, my youngest son, we're in Florida, right? This happened in Texas. But the pros and the cons of social media, the pros and cons of 24-hour news cycle, there was video of, the shooter from last week and at the grocery store. You can't get away from it. And he is just absolutely distraught and going, where is the humanity? Where is the compassion? This is a 23-year-old young man who is saying this, right? Who had that secondary exposure. And this is why it's really important that we all have to understand that it doesn't matter where you are when the event occurs. We are all being impacted and we have to address it as a community.
So millions of Americans are burned out. They're depressed. Some of them might have suicidal thoughts. What your research shows is that we're on a collision course between high levels of trauma and an ill-prepared workplace.
Yeah. Because we're not, right? This is not something that we've been discussing in a workplace, because we've also been taught, our generation, Melissa, you leave that stuff at the door when you walk into
never
your workplace.
Never complain, never explain.
That's right. Exactly.
Stiff upper lip. I was raised that way, and I think a lot of other people were. You keep things to yourself.
Yep.
You don't complain. You don't put all your stuff out there. If you play hurt, in other words. That was the work ethic that I was raised with.
Fake it till you make it. Don't let them see you sweat.
Absolutely.
That's it.
And that, that works for a while until it doesn't anymore.
Well, let's break down a little bit about what trauma is, because we are hearing that word a lot. And so we have to also be very careful that we're not saying that everything is trauma. When someone steals your lunch from the refrigerator, you might be angry and just kind of ticked off. That's not trauma, right? I'm being funny, but it's true.
Yeah.
So let's just break this down a little bit. So when we talk about trauma, we're talking about an event plus the experience that equals the effect. Real simple, right? So the event plus experience and then the effect. So the event is easy, right? It can be an episodic event. We know that there's a lot of trauma with sexual assault, domestic violence. So it can be a singular event. But what we're seeing now is the constant, the collective trauma over and over and over again. And we're not wired to handle that. And so the experience then is, well, what's your worldview? What worldview did you have when the event occurred? What a previous exposure did you have when the event occurred? What are the community norms when the event occurred? The result or the effects of that is what we're seeing in the workplace, right? This is what we're seeing. We're seeing decreased concentration, insomnia, irritability. People are not their best selves. Mm-hmm. They're just high, depression, disassociation. I mean, how many of us are going into work and just not being able to make decisions? We have brain fog. These are the effects of the trauma. And over and over and over again, how in the world do we function? We can't. Now, I also want to just say that I said this earlier about what a trauma-informed leader is. And I said it's about a leader who is not making decisions or making decisions for a do-no-harm lens. But part of what my effort is, Melissa, is to get leaders like us to think about our own crap. Mm. Because it starts with us. We cannot be good leaders until we address our own trauma, our own collective trauma. And that's the journey that I have personally been on, and being able to share that with others. So we have to be able, as a leader in this community, we've got to look at ourselves. We got to figure out what trauma is causing all of the effects that we're bringing into the leadership role, and then help our staff deal with what's going on.
We're talking about America's collective trauma on the show right now with Dr. Don Emmerich, LinkedIn Learning Instructor. What are your thoughts about this? Do you feel traumatized? Do you feel anxious? And do you feel that the workplace could do a better job of dealing with that? It's 549-2937. Jimmy tweets the show, "This all flies in the face of our cultural norms, at least for those of us who grew up Gen Xers." I think he was getting back to what you mentioned a few minutes ago, that mm-hmm. you suck it up.
Yeah.
That's the way we were raised. But as you try to change this dynamic, you are partnering up with LinkedIn to bring about a really ambitious goal. Mm. Tell us about it.
You know, so in my TED Talk last year here in Jacksonville, I submitted a challenge. And the challenge is that we need to collectively try to train 1 million trauma-informed leaders by the year 2031. And so since then, and for the last 2 years, that's what I've been working on and trying to get other people to come into this space and help train other leaders to be a do-no-harm leader. And so LinkedIn was a great, they recruited me. I was just so honored. And so they saw me as a thought leader in this space, one with influence, and certainly they also wanted to be first to market, right? So they're an online learning professional development entity, just like some of the other online professional development course entities, and they wanted to be first to market with this. And how honorable is it that I was the one that they asked to do that? What's really remarkable is I'm going to really help get that 1 million marker, right? And that, you know, LinkedIn's target is managers, it's supervisors, it's aspiring or emerging leaders. So the target audience is just perfect. And so far, we've just launched less than a month ago, and I have just about 1,800 learners that have completed my course, and we're just getting started.
Okay, so what is to be learned? How do you change the workplace? If you could, give us an example of how this works at someone's job.
So there's a variety of things. Let me just give you a metaphor, right? Because this is not an easy fix. So imagine you have a fishbowl, right? So you have this fishbowl with fish in it, and then you have a dirty fishbowl. What we're seeing businesses do right now, it's Mental Health Awareness Month, and you're seeing more and more businesses that are coming out saying that they want to destigmatize mental health and expand mental health services, which is excellent. It's a first step. But mental health services is an access point for the individual. We need to think about the system. We need to think about the entire system that could be creating that re-traumatization or the secondary trauma. With that said, so you have this fishbowl and you have a fish sitting in a dirty fishbowl. The mental health services that businesses now are expanding kind of just takes that fish and puts them into a clean fishbowl for about an hour. But where does that fish have to go? That fish has to go back into the dirty fishbowl. And so if you have a toxic environment, then that mental health service is great, but it's not going to be effective. We have to look at how is that fishbowl getting dirty all the time over and over and over again? Let's fix that. So we do that by, again, looking at how are we as an organization and as a leader, you know, are we creating psychologically safe environments? Are we creating trust? If we have a cultural norm in our business and in our community where we are on a heightened alert every single day and that we fear everyone and everything, that comes into the office. It comes into the workplace. So how do we trust our peers if we can't trust the system? Peer support and healing, collaboration, voice and choice, cultural, historical, and gender. Those are the pillars of a trauma-informed leader that then sort of exudes out into creating the environment that emphasizes all of those principles.
549-2937. Josh in Jacksonville. Hi, Josh. Good morning.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I just wanted to say this has been very informative. Thank you so much for your time and sharing this information. I think as an American, you know, I keep hearing people say, oh, we live in a sick world. It's the world we live in. But truthfully, I think we're being dishonest when we say that. It isn't the world that is sick. It is our nation. This is an American issue, this gun violence issue. And I'm a teacher myself, and while I work in a small private school, I'd be lying if I said I didn't have fears coming into my classroom every day. And, you know, teachers have enough stresses on a daily basis without having to consider what was once unthinkable, which has become so thinkable. And I'm a very positive person generally, but I've really found myself becoming extremely negative, pessimistic, and cynical about the future of this nation. And I don't know how to really move forward with that. It just seems like while these conversations are very important, so much of our rhetoric is how do we deal with collective grief and trauma? And of course, that's extremely important, but where's the action from our legislators? Where's the action from our politicians besides this, the ridiculous thoughts and prayers that, you know, seemingly come up every time there's one of these horrible events? So again, I want to thank both of you for your work and sharing your ideas. I just want to see action taken.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's, you know, I don't know if you can speak to that, if you're in your experience, ma'am, if you've spoken with legislators about how we can actually address these things. It just feels like this cycle of hopelessness, and it's overwhelming for me, and I'm sure many other Americans. So
thank you very much, Josh,
for taking my call and everything you all do on a daily basis. I appreciate it greatly.
Thank you so much, Josh. And he has given voice to the way so many of us feel. People feel hopeless. They feel powerless. And you know what else? He also made mention of the fact that people don't feel safe at work.
Mm-hmm.
For obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
What if your workplace gets shot up?
Mm-hmm.
How do you even deal with that in your consulting work?
Yeah. So first of all, everything that I was hearing Josh say, I was going back to when we defined what trauma is, right? The event, the experience, the effect. What we heard Josh talk about was the effect. This is affecting him like so many others, right? That's the space that we're in. When we work with workplaces, so there are design mechanisms. That is not my field. I'm not an architect, but there are specialties in the architectural and design space for trauma-informed work. And it's about, you know, again, a real quick example. I went to church 2 weeks ago, and it's a new church I went into, and literally walked in the door. And what's the first thing that I did? It was just
check the exits.
It was automatic, Melissa.
Where are the exits?
I wanted to know where the exits were and where is the safest place for me to sit in case someone came in.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, right?
When I go into a restaurant, I never, ever sit with my back.
That's exactly right.
The front door. So that's one example of how I carry trauma around. And millions of other people are doing the same thing. I always have an eye to the door.
Mm-hmm.
I always know where the exits are.
Yep.
Living this way year in, year out, it's physically destroying us over time.
That's right. And that's why the system approach is really important. It's not just about the individual. And again, I don't want to come hard on anyone, any business that is taking the step to expand mental health services. It's great. But that is an individual approach. It's a person-to-person approach. We have to look at the systems and the way that we design our businesses and our way that our cubicles are and where our offices are. There is clearly evidence that does help. And so that's a whole nother topic that we could definitely dive into, but those are our ways. I would also say policies like working from home. I know it's such a debatable topic, but working from home and giving people the opportunity to continue to work from home is a trauma-informed approach. We know that there are just certain positions that you have to be in the workplace. We know that, right? But being able to give those folks the opportunity to work at home, we had so many people, I heard, that yesterday did not send their children to school. Mm-hmm. All right, so these are working families that chose not to send their children to school. So are they having to take PTO because they're trying to console their child? Is there an opportunity where that could have been a work from home situation to where now they don't feel guilty or economically, you know, stressed because they're trying to cope and to work with their children for not going to school? This is a trauma-informed approach, and that's a policy, right?
Yeah, and that's the leader of the company needs to make it clear that those flexibilities are there. On Facebook, Stephanie says, I've been living on adrenaline for 2+ years. The politics of the shooting are devastating. We want the same things for our children. Then add in the exhaustion of the pandemic. Yesterday, it hit me that the new normal includes mass shootings, and I've been in a horrible funk. First responders are at higher risk of suicide. She goes on to say more. So with all of that said, Dawn, I think it's so obvious how much pain so many people are in. How can leaders get in touch with you, learn more, and begin this work at their organizations?
That's a great question. And the easiest way is that many of these organizations, private, public, and nonprofit, if you have access to LinkedIn Learning, you can go on, not just with my course, but there is an amazing amount of content there that if you are a business and have a corporate membership to LinkedIn, you can design really good online training, including becoming a trauma-informed leader in that. So that's the first thing. That's at your fingertips. And it's nominal in terms of the cost if you are a company, a larger or medium-sized company here. I also do free trainings every single month. It's virtual, so it's accessible to everyone. It's free. If you have Zoom and you know how to get online, you can access that free training. It is, go on my website, DawnEmmerichConsulting.com, and I have that free training as well as many other if you want to do advanced. Here's what businesses can do, and I can try to get this real quickly. Let me also just say, we need to stop waiting on our legislature. If Sandy Hook was not a message, we need to stop waiting, right? And so communities, families, people who are calling in and leaving messages now, we need to rally locally and we need to create change at the local level and demand that we have systems and norms in this community here in Jacksonville. We can start it here, right? And it takes us. This conversation has been going on for a long time. There are members, there are people here in Jacksonville that have been doing trauma-informed work. They're trying to organize right now. I'm the newcomer to this. There are people that have been doing it for a long time. What I will say is, but the business conversation has been absent. And that's what I'm bringing into the conversation. So we need to have a collective community response, put pressure on the legislature, but we need to stop waiting for this crap. We got to get going and start protecting our children and our families. Here's some other things that you can do. We need to look at creating a safe and anti-stigma culture within your organization. You can do mental health first aid training now. That's another really great way of looking at it. Address the root cause in the organization. Are your leaders the ones who are hurt? Are they the ones that are creating a lot of the trauma, re-triggering in the workplace? That's why the leadership training is really important. And then just to start doing the work. Get services, start doing the work, and push for systemic changes in your company as well as in the community. And I'm ready to work with whoever is ready. I'm ready to go. And Jacksonville is my home. This is where I've lived for 25 plus years. And I'm happy to, let's just go, Melissa. I'm sick and tired of it.
I think a lot of people are. DawnEmmerichConsulting.com. Dr. Dawn, thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
And much more still ahead later. A preview of this weekend's Jazz Fest. But up next.
8 U.S. senators and 139 members of the U.S. House of Representatives refused to certify the election results despite no legitimate basis for objection.
Our contributor Chris Hand on the urgency of reforming the Electoral Count Act next. Well, an urgent change is needed to our election laws to prevent another coup attempt. So says our regular contributor, Chris Hand. It's today's Hands On.
I'm the guy who does his job. You must be the other guy. If you have seen Martin Scorsese's 2006 Academy Award-winning film, The Departed, you may recognize that dialogue. A Massachusetts state police technician undermines a crucial surveillance operation and then compounds his mistake by asking Staff Sergeant Sean Dignam, played by Mark Wahlberg, to identify himself. Dignam's response, about being the guy who does his job as opposed to the other guy, is one of the most memorable lines from the movie. As someone who closely observes government, I've thought about that dialogue often in recent years. While there are public officials who do their jobs, we have also seen examples of others auditioning for the part of the other guy. One such instance occurred on January 6, 2021. In November 2020, a clear majority of more than 81 million voters chose Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to be the next president and vice president of the United States. The following month, the U.S. Electoral College awarded Biden and Harris the 306 electoral votes earned from the states they won. Yet 8 U.S. senators and 139 members of the U.S. House of Representatives refused to certify the election results despite no legitimate basis for objection. Of course, we know what else happened on January 6, 2021, a violent insurrection which halted the certification process for hours, damaged the United States Capitol, and resulted in the deaths of or injuries to U.S. Capitol police officers. If you think another January 6 can't happen, think again. One of the people who participated in the January 6 protests recently became the Republican nominee for governor of Pennsylvania, State Senator Doug Mastriano. In 2020, Mastriano falsely claimed Donald Trump won the Keystone State. He urged the legislature to select electors who would choose Trump even though voters chose Biden. Mastriano has promised, if elected, to require voters to re-register, limit voting by mail, and decertify county election machines. In 2024, Pennsylvania will cast 19 electoral votes. Earlier this week, Georgians went to the polls for state primary elections. While two officials who resisted pressure to change the 2020 outcome, Governor Brian Kemp and Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, won their elections decisively, another contest had a different result. State Senator Burt Jones finished first in his primary election for lieutenant governor. In 2020, Jones supported Trump's inaccurate claims of a stolen election. He attempted to persuade the Georgia legislature to overturn Joe Biden's win in the state and tried to delay congressional certification. In 2024, Georgia will cast 16 electoral votes. But there is something Congress can do to safeguard the will of voters in future elections. Update the Electoral Count Act, which governs how Congress tabulates electoral votes. Enacted when Grover Cleveland was president, the Electoral Count Act is now 135 years old. Because parts of the law are imprecise, it was the basis for incorrect claims that a vice president could unilaterally overturn the election result and for congressional opposition to certifying the vote count. The potentially promising news is that a bipartisan coalition of U.S. senators is working to modernize the Electoral Count Act. House leaders have also been engaged on the issue. Their changes could clarify the role of the vice president, make it harder for senators and House members to challenge valid state electoral vote counts, and implement other reforms designed to prevent a repeat of what happened in Congress on January 6th, or something even worse. Every member of Congress takes the same oath of office. I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely, without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I am about to enter. So help me God. Time is of the essence. If members of Congress want to fulfill that oath of office, they should prioritize clarifying the Electoral Count Act before the end of 2022. Such an action would give supportive elected officials of both parties the right to say that they were the ones who did their jobs to support and defend the Constitution, not the other guys. I'm Chris Hand.
Chris Hand was an elector himself in 2008 in the election of Barack Obama. Let's turn our attention once again to this city's affordable housing crisis. You may not have known this, but there is no rent control in Florida because it's against the law. Meanwhile, rents in the region are climbing by more than twice the rate of inflation. A basic one-bedroom apartment now is getting close to $2,000 a month. Our Jacksonville Today team has been looking into this, examining how much rent has gone up neighborhood by neighborhood. And they've got some potential solutions to the housing crisis. Reporter Claire Heddles is here with more. Hey, good morning.
Hi, Melissa.
And if you're out there paying rent that's just too high, you're struggling to pay the rent, we want to hear from you right now. Give us a call. Let us know what you're paying for rent and how you're able to afford it. 549-2937. Okay, so let's begin with the fact that rent control is against the law in Florida.
Right, so we've been answering readers' housing questions at Jacksonville Today, and we got a question this week that we thought was interesting from a reader from the Northeast who said, why is there no rent control in Florida like there is in New Jersey and New York? And it turns out it goes back to one of the last times inflation was rising as quickly as it is now. In the mid-70s, we were seeing inflation rise about 10% each year, and cities across the country implemented rent control ordinances, including Miami Beach. Landlords there fought back. They took it to court. Courts upheld it. They said you can have rent control. So those landlords started lobbying state lawmakers in the 70s, and we got this Florida law that bans rent control. And then according to archival reporting, that was really what set the precedent for almost three dozen other states to also pass rent control bans back in the 70s. So fast forward to now, there is one exception in this law that if you're in a housing emergency, you can pass a one-year rent control ordinances. This is for local jurisdictions, local governments. But to date, as far as our research shows and what we've heard from attorneys in counties that are considering this option, no local jurisdiction has done that. But that could change this year.
That could change. Some cities in Florida may go that route.
Right. So we just saw Orange County, where Orlando is, commission a study to determine whether or not they have a housing emergency. The term in the law hasn't really been defined yet because no local government has tried to use this provision under the law, so this would be the first time. So what Orange County commissioners decided to do is fund a study to determine that there's a housing emergency. And then if that consultant says these are the reasons there's a housing emergency, then they could have a public referendum for a one-year rent control ordinance. So even if there is a housing emergency, you can only pass a one-year rent control ordinance, but it would be the first time in Florida that we do have a rent control ordinance since the mid-70s.
Since the mid-70s. And nothing like that on the horizon in Jacksonville, we need to note.
So local advocates have been advocating for this same thing to happen in Jacksonville. They're saying it's time to declare a housing emergency here so that we can move forward on this possibility of a one-year rent control ordinance. What advocates told City Council a couple weeks ago is they were saying it's only 1 year, but it would give families time to save money and prepare for rent going back up. And it could allow the city to implement some of the more long-term solutions that our partners at the Jackson have also been looking into, like incentivizing development and changing zoning laws
to get more housing.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of calls. Janine in Jacksonville. Hi, Janine. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I was just commenting on the rent here in Florida. It is absolutely insane. I moved back to Jacksonville from South Florida, which is very, very expensive, about 4 years ago. And I moved in with a friend who owned her home until I got on my feet. Well, about 6 months ago, I decided that I wanted to get an apartment, live by myself. So when I went to look, the average apartment was $1,500 a month for a one-bedroom apartment here. The same apartment I used to live in 10 years ago that was $650 is now $1,250. Mm-hmm. So I decided, well, if I'm going to pay that kind of money, I might as well buy a house. Something is wrong if I went and bought a house and I pay less in a mortgage for a three-bedroom house than I could for a one-bedroom apartment.
I hear you, Janine.
I'm lucky that I was able to do that. Not everybody is.
Not everybody is. That's right.
Something is wrong in this economy when we cannot afford rent, but we can afford a mortgage.
Thanks, Janine. Thank you. Not to cut you off. Rebecca in Lakewood. Go, Rebecca.
Hi, yes. My rent went up by $270 this past
week, and I'm actually moving back to Kentucky because I cannot afford that. I looked at housing where my family lives in Louisville, and it's much less expensive mm-hmm. than here. And it's very disappointing because I love Jacksonville, but it's too expensive to live here anymore. I've been here for 25 years, and now I have to move, although I'll be happy to be close to family. Had my rent not skyrocketed, I would have stayed here.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
I'm very sad about that.
I'm sorry to hear it. Thanks, Rebecca, for sharing your story. Douglas in Jacksonville, we've got a landlord on the line now. Hi, Douglas.
Hi, yes. I have a rental property here in Jacksonville, and I've really tried to never raise rent on the tenants that were there. And, like, I don't even know how to have that conversation with them right now that my insurance has literally doubled. It went from, like, $1,600 to almost $3,000. And my taxes have almost doubled as well. And, like, I feel like I have to raise rent because now I'm losing money every month on the house, whereas, like, you know, the rent isn't paying the mortgage and it's not paying the taxes and insurance. And so it's like, what do you do? Like, you're a landlord, but you're put in this tough situation where you haven't raised rent, you don't want to raise rent. The only reason I got it was to, you know, earn equity. I wasn't trying to make, like, a profit or anything, but now, you know, now I feel like I'm the bad guy in, you know, social media and the news and all of that because I'm a landlord and I might have to raise rent on someone.
Yeah, Douglas, I appreciate that. And I'm sorry you're dealing with this. And I want to thank you for calling. That's Douglas calling in, giving the perspective of the landlord. And so we've heard from tenants now and landlords, Claire, and the pain is out there.
Yeah, that was an interesting perspective. I mean, all these things are interconnected. We saw the state legislature having a special session this week to talk about property insurance, and we saw some Democratic lawmakers saying, you know, really this is helping insurers more than it's helping ratepayers like property owners, like the landlord we just heard from. So we might see some relief on that property insurance cost, but it doesn't seem clear that it's guaranteed with the legislation that was recently passed. But as some of the tenants were saying, the rent has increased 30% since the start of the pandemic in Jacksonville. It had already been climbing in Jacksonville for years, and then that largest increase just over the last two years. One interesting thing about this rent control possibility is that the law restricts the one-year rent control ordinance if a local government declares a housing emergency to, quote, luxury apartments. And in the 70s, that was apartments that were less than $250 a month. So some attorneys have calculated that by inflation and would say, you know, you could argue that it's $1,200, which is what $250 would be equivalent to. But even still, $1,200 is far below the average rent in Jacksonville. So even if we were able to get this rent control ordinance, there are some, or if advocates were able to get a rent control ordinance, there are some legal questions about where it would apply, and it might not even apply to most apartments.
Not only that, Tallahassee has had a way in recent years of stamping out anything municipalities around Florida try to do at the local level. Could they override, say, Orange County if they institute rent control or some kind of housing relief?
Right. So that's, I mean, the interesting thing about the law that Orange County is now thinking of taking this provision from is that it really hasn't been challenged before in court because no local jurisdiction has tried it yet. So there is a lot of potential flexibility and legal arguments as to how it could be applied. And so there is quite a bit of wiggle room for landlords and or state lawmakers to push back against counties that are considering this. We're also seeing Miami-Dade County next month is considering commissioning a similar study to move forward on declaring a housing emergency and potential rent control ordinance.
Meanwhile, at jackstoday.org, you do take a look at neighborhoods around the city. Can you tell us about that?
So we looked at where rent had risen the most across the city, and we saw, you know, we looked over the past 2 years and over the past 5 years, and we saw by and large low-income tenants were hit the hardest over the past 5 years. Of the five zip codes that saw their rent increase by more than 60% over the past 5 years, three had a medium household income of less than $32,000 a year. So we're seeing rents rising and hitting low-income tenants. the hardest. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, they've been climbing for years, but the largest uptick was in the past 2 years and at more than twice the rate of inflation.
Judy emails the show, multiple families are now piling into single family homes. It was the same thing after the housing crash, she says. So people are doing whatever they can to be able to afford to get a roof over their heads right now, right?
And this goes to one of the points that the Jackson makes in a recent article in Jacksonville Today as well about single family zoning, that there's zoning laws all over, or zoning restrictions all over Jacksonville that make it so that there can only be single family homes and not homes in the back house or in the garage or duplexes or townhomes. And those are the kinds of things that can fill in for families that are, you know, all moving in together into one single family home.
Right. And let's take one more call. It's Bill at the Beaches. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes. Just to refer you to, and many people can remember if you're old enough, that New York, and to some extent, still has rent control. And rent-controlled properties are not properties that investors or people want to own, because if you cap what the owner can do in terms of rents, he doesn't have enough money to put money back into a building that's never going to pay off. He can't sell it to another person if there's rent control and he's trapped in it. And many buildings in New York were abandoned for that very reason. And if you go back and look at the photographs from these places, they made movies out of it, et cetera, they were just abandoned blocks and blocks and blocks of homes, of apartment complexes because of rent control. So you have to be careful if you want to start attaching what you feel about people into policy, because you could really destroy an entire industry very quickly. You start very small and then it expanded. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Okay. What about that? Sometimes these efforts to help can have unintended effects.
Yeah, I think he makes a good point. There's a lot of arguments about rent control, whether or not it has been effective in places that have implemented rent control. There's definitely a large lobby against rent control, but there also are very valid points, as he's making, that it can restrict development or revitalization of buildings. And so it is definitely a controversial solution. And in Florida, it's not even an option as a long-term solution. I think what some local advocates are saying, that there is a provision in the law for a one-year solution that might be a short-term. And that's what Orange County commissioners and Miami-Dade County commissioners are now considering as a stopgap, but not as a long-term solution. And I think in Jacksonville, we haven't seen that stopgap solution considered yet, but we might if that precedent is set by Orange County or Miami-Dade County this year.
Claire Heddles at Jax Today. Thanks for sharing vital information. And up next, previewing Jazz Fest weekend. We'll be right back.
Jessica Palumbo here. I'm the editor of Jacksonville Today. Readers describe our free morning newsletter like this.
It quickly became part of my morning reading routine.
Even when the news is horrible, I love the balance with arts and culture and other fun information.
I actually look forward to Monday morning now.
See for yourself. Sign up at jaxtoday.org. That's jaxtoday.org.
Got me going.
Currently in heavy rotation on the independent 89.9 HD4, new music from dream pop duo Beach House, indie rock bops from Wet Leg, the latest from Father John Misty, Big Thief, Mitski, and Robert Glasper. But that's just scratching the surface of what you'll hear on WJCT's new music discovery station. It's all handpicked, and it's streaming everywhere. Listen on 89.9 HD4, the WJCT app, or on jaxmusic.org.
Next time on The World, construction workers in India travel from city to city, job to job. Many live at the building site where they work, along with their children. For some, there's support from daycare services right on the construction site.
Where each and every child living on the site is safe, happy, and educated.
Mobile daycare in Mumbai. It's on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Scott Tong. The elementary school shooting in Uvalde, Texas is the 27th school shooting this year. We'll learn more about what happened and calls for action to prevent mass shootings and gun violence in this country. That and the latest news from Ukraine and elsewhere. Next time on Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
New data suggests more kids in America are not being immunized for diseases like measles and meningitis. Some parts of the country are seeing signs that COVID vaccine concerns are starting to spill over into routine immunizations. That has doctors worried that preventable and possibly fatal diseases could become more common, putting the routine back into routine shots. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Memorial Day weekend is almost here, and that means the Jazz Festival is too. Shelton Hull of JME, our Jacksonville Music Experience, is on the line with a preview of all the fun. Hey, Shelton.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Good to talk to you. So some really great headliners are coming in, like Herbie Hancock and many others. I think Patti LaBelle. What's on your radar for the Jazz Fest?
Well, there's all kinds of things going on this weekend. We've got, by my count, about 52 hours of live music from at least 29 different acts. I'll be emceeing on Saturday on the Groovin' stage on Bay Street. That will feature the Ray Callender Quartet. That'll feature the Jacksonville Jazz Festival Hall of Fame All-Stars and a variety of other things. You've got the jam session on Saturday night. And, of course, Herbie Hancock on Friday night. It's going to be one of the best things that you'll see in terms of live music here all year long. And then if you have a chance, after Herbie Hancock's done, go right over to Underbelly to check out LPT.
Oh, yeah, they're great. Now, not only that, there's a piano competition at the Florida Theater. That sounds fun, too.
That's right. The Jazz Piano Competition begins tonight at the Florida Theater, also the same night as Pride Night at the Symphony. But the piano competition has produced a number of superstars over the years, going all the way back to, I believe, 1982, when Marcus Roberts narrowly edged out a future star named Harry Connick Jr. And again, the piano competition tonight will be the only part of the festival that's actually indoors. The rest of it is outdoors all throughout the downtown urban core area, and everything is free and family friendly as well.
Now, RJME, the Jacksonville Music Experience, has put together a great list of what to see and hear, and we'll be celebrating Jazz Week at the Independent 89.9 HD4 with lots of great music. So tell us a little bit more about what you're doing over at jacksmusic.org.
Well, you know, JME is a great thing that we've developed, a great platform that we've developed over the last couple of years. A big shout out to Matthew Shaw, who keeps the whole thing going, and Dave McGowan and David Luckin, who helped us put it together. The JME is really intended as a sort of platform to talk about the best of local music and music that's related to Jacksonville, because, of course, when you talk about the local music scene, you have to talk about musicians that are spread out all over the country and parts of the world that represent Jacksonville. And the JME, which now springs over into the Independent 89.9 HD4, it's a really nice platform. We did a lot of writing about the Jazz Festival this year, and just yesterday we commemorate the anniversary of Miles Davis's birth with a great article by Dan Brown that gets into some of the essential Miles Davis recordings. So when you go to JME, jacksmusic.org, you'll see tons of, you know, a couple hundred articles already written, in addition to playlists and videos, multimedia It's really a one-stop shop for everything related to our local music scene, which you'll get to see on really, really vibrant display throughout the weekend at the Jazz Festival.
Now, let's let people know once again where they can check you out, Shelton. You'll be on the Groovin' Stage, is that right?
The Groovin' Stage, it's on Bay Street, across the street from Justice Pub and the bars down there. On the site where the old Duval County Courthouse and the Annex is, I'll be emceeing there from 4 p.m. until about 10:30. But of course, I'll be out and about all weekend, so please come by and grab a selfie. Shake my hand, hug me. I like all that stuff.
And you will be a delight. Thank you so much for joining us. Have fun.
Thank you. I'll see you there.
And again, our JME guide to the festival, Jazz Week, on the Independent 89.9 HD4. Check it out. Listen and go to jacksmusic.org for more. And we'll close with a little jazz. Enjoy, everybody, and we'll see you at the festival this weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.